Okay. Hi, everybody. And we're going on. We're in rule number 14. It's one of the rules for rules of white magic for the physical plane. And we're on the third program for rule 14. And we're on the ninth program for the physical plane rules. And we've come to We've been through some pretty complex material, highly outlined, highly structured, and hopefully with a little bit of re-study, we will get it under our belt. It's been pretty much about the many, many energies which the aspiring white magician has to learn how to access, appropriate, properly direct from his own energy system once these energies are absorbed by the energy system, and how he has to note the kinds of energies which he seems to be emitting. He has to note the effect that they have upon the environment, and it's a close study by the inner man of all that is radiating, emanating from him, we might say. But now we get on to some very, I think, practical material, very sound and cogent advice. We've been given pretty much what the aspirant to white magic and to a closer relationship with the spiritual hierarchy has to do to fit himself or herself for that kind of role. And really, it's all about the right reception and transmission and direction of energy, all this in line with the divine plan. So here is the section called The Treading of the Way, and we stop there after a program that was just about 3.5 hours. Somehow I had, as usual, lost my chronometer reading, but it's pretty close to half-hour segments. The Treading of the Way. We have seen, as we have considered Rule 14, by the way, a rather long rule and somehow very potent. I think I want to read it, you know, again, because I think it's just so important to kind of have it in the back of our mind. So here we are. Get a zoom that is reasonable. And Treatise on White Magic, and here we go, Rule 14. Yes, the sound swells out. The hour of danger to the soul courageous draweth near. The waters have not hurt the white creator, and naught could drown nor drench him. Danger from fire and flame menaces now, and dimly yet the rising smoke is seen. Let him again, after the cycle of peace, call on the solar angel. So we do see it is, in terms of its wording, a relatively longer rule than some, and I suppose we have another, I don't know, maybe 40 pages in that rule. Okay, so I just wanted to get that in our minds. And I'll just copy it here. Why not? So this is, there it is, Rule 14. So that we can have it in front of our eye when we need to refer to it. Okay. So, as we've considered Rule 14, we've seen in the magical work the critical point of objectivity has now been reached by the aspirant. He's endeavoring to become a magical creator and to accomplish two things. Now, objectivity. Whoops. That's not right. We'll get a. In other words, we have reached the point. At which the inwardly created structure of thought and desire is to become tangible and objective, entering the etheric plane and the dense physical plane, and fires will be involved in that point of entry. There just seem to be a number of ways that in this dangerous process of magic that the practitioner can die in the process. We probably never think about that when thinking about various magical formulas and the possibility of working magic that seems to be held out or promised by some of the books. But yet it is true, there is danger and the possibility of a premature demise unless with purity and right connection to the soul, the solar angel, unless these things are sustained properly and the right procedure is used. It's a seventh ray process, and we know regarding the seventh ray that correct procedure, the right thing done at the right time for the right length of time, these things are indispensable. Okay, so the one who would become the magical creator has to accomplish two things. You know, I just get the sense that in another century, maybe another two centuries, some of these magical methods will be put into practice in a practical manner. Right now, there is the academic learning about them, but he tells us that if we apply ourselves to the academic studies now, it'll be that much easier in the future when the true practical formulas are given out. So what do we have to do? We have to recreate. He has to recreate his instrument or mechanism of contact so that the solar angel has a vehicle adequate for the expression of reality. And this involves, we noted, the right type, quality, strength, and speed. Or let's just say that spontaneous and even instantaneous precipitation that might be, as he says, even a better way of describing the fourth step than the word speed. So when we're aligned with the solar angel and in a deep communion with that solar angel, and it is a real being for us, then the solar angel will have an entity for expression of its intention. We spent quite a bit of time on the right type, which is related to the divine will and the right direction in a way of the various forces the quality which is magnetic, the strength which is persistent, and the speed which is spontaneous and operates when there are no obstructions. So we're trying to accomplish two things here. Recreate the instrument or mechanism of contact. Of course, in a way it already exists, but I think what we mean here is to activate it so that it is ready to function according to the will of the magician. And further, build those subsidiary forms of expression in the outer world through which the embodied energy flowing through the recreated sheaths can serve the world. So we are refining, well, let's just say making the sheaths fit and building in the world those forms which can receive and profit from the transmission of energy. I think we're all somehow responsible for building forms which truly help the divine plan to manifest. And I think this has something to do with that process. But let's elaborate on that a little bit. I mean, DK will elaborate on this. In the first case, the aspirant is dealing with himself, working within his own circumference, and thus learning to know himself, to change himself, yes, and to rebuild his form aspect. In other words, this is a spiritual training, and no one who is untrained and relatively unpurified can step in and perform successfully the white magical process. I don't know about the other kinds of magic. In many ways, it probably can be performed by those who have so many liabilities in terms of their motive, even though they may, we're told, pass through a purification process just for their own safety. So we're working within our own circumference, and know thyself, change thyself, rebuild thyself. This is necessary. Otherwise, the plan will be received and expressed in a distorted manner. In the other case, he is learning to be a server of the race. You know, he's building the forms which can serve. I think I'll put that down here. Building the forms through which he can serve, you know, various kinds of groups and organizations are built. Means, buildings, methods, patterns, whatever you want to call them, they do give access to those who must be served, and the energy can flow through those built forms and reach the people and or whomever one is serving, whatever kingdom, and lift them up. Various inventions come in here. We could probably think of many forms that are built for the purpose of service. And, you know, look at medicine and the surgical instruments that are created to perform certain procedures that could not be accomplished before that time. So there is a building process whereby to enhance the method whereby the inner energies reach and assist others. So in the other case, and that's case number two here, okay, in the first case, number one. And in the other case, let's call it number two. He's learning to be a server of the race and to construct those forms of expression which will embody the new ideas, formulation of ideas through thoughts, in books, in art. Man is a form-creating being at his present stage of development, whether he does that consciously or unconsciously. And this is a kind of conscious creation under the influence of love and goodwill and illumined mind and steadfast will to construct those forms of expression which will embody the new ideas, the emerging principles, and the new concepts which must govern and round out our racial progress. So all kinds of, you know, new inventions, new patterns are emerging. In the emergence of the new patterns come new possibilities for the elevation of man. The second ray is a ray, it's called the ray of the divine pattern, maybe then the ray of archetypes which are purposeful and found on the higher planes of being. And from those archetypal patterns come many subsidiary and transient patterns in time and space, many arrangements which will slowly work for the elevation. I mean, you know, just think, even very practical things. Let's think about education and medicine. There are some countries that see to the medical needs of their people because they have evolved patterns, systems which meet those needs. They see to the educational needs of their younger people and the training of those who are working for various kinds of jobs and professions. And patterns exist because they've been created to facilitate these things. Other countries don't do this at all. Those patterns are absent, and therefore the good that comes through the patterns of relationship, that good is missing. I speak about that because being a citizen of the United States and also a permanent resident here in Scandinavia. Okay, I think I had a little interruption there, but I was talking about Scandinavia, and I was talking about countries which see after their people and create patterns of service. Because when the right pattern is created, service can be offered. And countries that do not do that. And service patterns are very important. I think obviously the head has to be used as well as the heart. The heart may motivate, but the head has to design the method by which the energy, the right sort of applied energy and force will reach the people or whatever kingdom beneficently. I mean, there are those who serve the animal kingdom, those who serve the plant kingdom. And even, I suppose, in some ways, the mineral kingdom, and increasingly so. Once during the age of Aquarius, we understand more about how to do that. So constructing the forms which will embody forms of expression which will embody the new ideas, the emerging principles, the new concepts which must govern and round out our racial progress. And we have no idea about the patterns which will be conceived. to serve in the future. After all, it is a great age of service, isn't it? A water of life am I poured forth for thirsty men, thirsty human beings, thirsty people, you know, for the thirsty in whatever kingdom. We have these energies within our head center and all through our energy system, and we pour them forth without thought of our own welfare. We do have to maintain the instrument, of course, in order to continue to serve with effectiveness. So, you know, as DK was reminding his students, you cannot exhaust yourself entirely. You have to have recreation. You have to rest. You have to keep the instrument in maybe serviceable order so that service can really be offered. So it is a balance, really. So what have we here? Right. Okay. And what I was looking for here was simply what the magical creator is attempting to do, and he has to accomplish two things. He has to get his mechanism into a serviceable shape so that it can really endure in high quality service, and he has to build the patterns through which he can serve in the serve others, serve in the environment. Remember that no man is a disciple in the master's sense of the word who is not a pioneer. Well, that's quite a statement. I mean, we do have to break new ground, and we have to hew our way through the jungle of the ordinary and make new paths towards the accomplishment of new objectives. A registered response to spiritual truth, a realized pleasure in forward-looking ideals, and a pleased acquiescence in the truths of the New Age do not constitute discipleship. Whoa, that is a powerful statement, and it should cause us to evaluate our particular approach to spiritual truth and to forward-looking ideals and to the truths of the New Age. These do not constitute in and of themselves, although they are necessary, discipleship. If it were so, the ranks of disciples would be rapidly filled. And this is sadly not the case. So he's saying here, you know, in a way, well, he's saying it, there are not yet enough disciples. Well, this was being said in the late 20s, and when this book was being written, is it still the case? I think it is in many ways. In many ways, it is still the case. It is the ability to arrive at an understanding of the next realizations which lie ahead of the human mind, which marks the aspirant who stands at the threshold of accepted discipleship. Seems like we skipped over, the aspirant is a disciple of a kind, maybe a probationary disciple. It is the power wrought out in the crucible of strenuous inner experience, not just outer strenuous experience, to see the immediate vision and to grasp those concepts in which the mind must necessarily clothe that immediate vision, which gives the man the right to be a recognized worker with the plan, recognized by the great ones. That's acceptance, isn't it, in a way? If not recognized by the world. This is so defining, isn't it? So we're learning what really makes an aspirant, what really makes a disciple. There's nothing sentimental about this, and certainly there's nothing easy about it. The ability to arrive at an understanding of the next realizations, not the distant ones, but the next necessary ones, which will really help the present situation, the next realizations which lie ahead of the human mind, which mark the aspirant. He's part of the avant-garde, in a way, the forward-moving edge of the body that's moving progressively. And there's, you know, danger on the front lines, in a way. But further, and that aspirant stands at the threshold of accepted discipleship, already being a kind of disciple, we might say an accepting disciple, a probationary disciple, then an accepting disciple. And before long, when their real work is accomplished and Saturn and Mercury are really put discriminatively to use, an accepted disciple. It is the power. Notice how that word comes in here. It's an augmentation over simply ability that was describing the aspirant. It is the power wrought out in the crucible of strenuous inner experience to see the immediate vision and to grasp those concepts in which the mind must necessarily clothe it, you know, to be effective so people can assimilate it, because you have to speak in such a language and with concepts that the immediate possibilities of the future can be registered, and the people who receive them can acquiesce in the idea that they must be accomplished. It's doing these things which give a man the right to be recognized, a recognized worker with a plan, recognized by the great ones, if not recognized by the world. And I guess this can be called accepted disciple, and maybe ship, accepted discipleship. Now, let's see what else, because there's more. It is the achievement of that spiritual orientation held steady, no matter what the outer disturbance in the physical plane life may be, that signifies to those who watch and seek for workers that a man can be trusted to deal with some small aspect of their undertaken work. It is the capacity to submerge and to lose sight of the personal lower self in the task of world guidance, undersoul impulse, which lifts a man out of the ranks of the aspiring mystics into those of the practical, though mystically minded, occultists. So this is yet another step, and maybe we can call such a step by the name senior disciple, advanced disciple, something of that nature. So we have aspirant to accepted discipleship. We have the accepted disciple, and we have the more senior disciple, who is also a probationary initiate. Well, all of these stages, they kind of overlap, and it's really difficult to make them cut and dried, as it were, because that takes away the livingness of them. A human individual interested in the spiritual work can be a number of things simultaneously. So anyway, power is involved, and also this persistence, the strength of persistence that we have studied to hold steady, no matter what the outer disturbance of physical life, plain life, maybe even probably many of us have no idea of how steadily some of those who have gone before and who've achieved, how steadily they have held under circumstances that might prevent us from doing the work. But they have achieved, and they have negated what to so many would be an inhibitory outer disturbance. And there are those who do watch and who do judge, and they judge when a human being can be brought into closer rapport with the ashram that they have gathered. You know, it's symbolic perhaps, but it's really vibratory. Where we stand with respect to the ashram, it depends on our the degree of our skill, our selflessness, our mental illumination, our love, the degree to which we can appropriate spiritual will and express it, certainly as goodwill and later as the will to good. There are many markers which the great ones looking on, by which they can judge. And Mary Bailey used to say, you know, the position that a disciple holds is all about what she called spheres of responsibility. Now, presumably, a highly trained disciple, an advanced disciple, can deal with a sphere of responsibility which is larger and more demanding than a less trained disciple. And so this is the way that enlargement occurs. You fit yourself for the task, and as Master Moria said, at one point, it's kind of it's a demand which awakens you to the seriousness of the whole process. He says, make yourself indispensable. Make yourself indispensable. It's not necessarily by, you know, calling yourself in an egotistical manner, indispensable. I am indispensable. Not that. It's just work so hard and so skillfully and so effectively that actually you really must be welded into the great work, because maybe, you know, you're one of the only ones that can do it. Maybe you're really needed to make the great work succeed. Now we're getting to a section of the book that I've often quoted, because it has to do with advice which is, indispensable. So this is an intensely practical work on which we are engaged. You know, he's dealt with many rules of magic, and he's dealt with them in cosmic fire in a more abstracted sense, and now he's getting into the implications of these rules in the life of the striving disciple. I don't think we can approach, we can be an aspirant to becoming the white magician, but I think only those who are really disciples can hope to be in any way effective in this process. And even they, not entirely. I think one must really be a third degree initiate and beyond to be called the true white magician, instead of somebody who is interested in and attracted to the process. This is an intensely practical work on which we are engaged. It is likewise of such proportions that it will occupy all of a man's attention and time, even his entire thought life, and will lead him to efficient expression in his personality, task, imposed by karmic limitation and inherited tendency, and to a steadfast application of the creative and magical work. I think I must read it again. Intensely practical work. It will occupy all of a man's attention and time, even his entire thought life, and will lead him to efficient expression in his personality task. Notice the efficiency aspect there, the third aspect, imposed by karmic limitation and inherited tendency. And what is that personality task for any one of us? And what are the karmic limitations which have drawn the circle within which we have to undertake that personality task? Every one of us should, as I say, see how we got where we are and how our spiritualized personality task is indicated by not only our aspirations and our the types of energies we appropriate, but by karmic factors which hold us within a certain ring pass knot and demanding that we perform efficiently within that ring pass knot. Discipleship is a synthesis of hard work, intellectual unfoldment, steady aspiration, and spiritual orientation, plus the unusual qualities of positive harmlessness and the opened eye which sees at will into the world of reality. So this is real discipleship, and this is a kind of discipleship as it appears when a man is no longer called a disciple. Well, we're all disciples. Even the planetary logos is a disciple of the solar logos, and on it goes. So there is a relativity of terms, but the later part of the sentence indicates a more advanced stage. Well, this is one of those sentences which we read and which steadily constitutes guidance for us and a clarification of what we might have thought the discipleship was. A synthesis of hard work. Notice he puts that first, doesn't he? Interesting. Because it's not just that pleased acquiescence in ideals and interesting thoughts and, oh, how interesting that is, but we don't work at it, you know. It's not that. It's a synthesis of hard work, intellectual unfoldment. So the mind has to be well focused. The man has to be focused, at least mentally, even if not entirely polarized mentally. That's maybe a later stage between the second and third initiation. Steady aspiration, not fitful, and spiritual orientation, always looking to the east symbolically, looking to the downflow of energy from the soul and looking for ways of identifying as the soul. And here comes the plus, which has to be added on as we become accepted disciples. And even for them, it's certainly not perfect, right? Plus the unusual qualities of positive harmlessness, which is not a passive acquiescence when unpleasant circumstances strike. We may have to take, in being harmless, DK advises us, we may have to take even drastic action. So there's not, harmlessness sometimes suggests some kind of passivity. But it is not so. There's poise in it. There's a completed point of view. There's a divine understanding, perfect poise, a completed point of view, divine understanding, a number of Libran qualities, though whatever your sign may be, you can achieve this, can and must achieve this positive harmlessness. I think the soul, from its perspective, or we as the soul, are always harmless. But when we descend into greater limitation of perception, then we are perhaps no longer harmless and fight for the prerogatives of our personality over the prerogatives of the personality of others. And so there is this friction in the world of fire by friction instead of harmony in the world of solar fire. Positive harmlessness and the opened eye, the eye of Shiva, which sees at will into the world of reality. And there, this opened eye, you know, this is this triangle of the head center, the ajna, and the ultra major center must be completed and functioning. And it seems to evoke the powers of the third eye. And it's more an achievement of the third initiation. So, right, we've reached that point where we can continue with these very important injunctions, pieces of advice that eventually will make of us the adept. And we are just about, I don't know, perhaps at that hour-long point. I'm going to just keep going here. A bit of irregularity here toward the end of the book, but it seems that it is necessary to finish this work. Certain considerations should be brought to the notice of the disciple, which, for the sake of clarity, we will tabulate. To become an adept, it will be necessary for the disciple too, and then we will look at what are the necessities. Remember that the adept is that rare efflorescence of a generation of inquirers, or enquirers, depending whether we're using American English or British English. And let's just say that we are at that point, I believe, I want to say about an hour has passed in 14.3. So this is serious business here, because quite a number of fifth degree initiates will be needed, says the Tibetan, and needed in short order, in a short time. Well, during the Aquarian Age, some of these will appear, and maybe even more in the subsequent age of Capricorn, which is, the third initiation is related to Aquarius and related to Capricorn, and the fourth initiation definitely to Aquarius. And I would say many disciples or initiates end their quest for mastership in the sign Aquarius. So maybe the achievement, much achievement, will come in Aquarius, and certainly quite a bit more in as well in the age of Capricorn. Here are the requirements, which I so often repeat, and the question is, can we do them? Number one, inquire the way. Number two, obey the inward impulses of the soul. I think I always pronounce it inner, so that's a mistake I've just caught. Inward impulses of the soul. Number three, pay no attention to any worldly consideration. And number four seems simple enough, but probably is the hardest to execute. Live a life which is an example to others. So let me make these bigger and emphasize them. Somehow, maybe I'm under the illusion that by doing that, they will have a greater chance of impacting my consciousness and the consciousness of others. Okay. So now he's going to explain these very practical injunctions, demands, pieces of advice, rules, whatever we want to call them. They are ways which, if followed with persistence, with intelligence, with the proper technique, they will lead to adeptship. They will lead to mastership. Okay, that's a better word yet. Requirements. Requirements. Requirements for transiting to adeptship. These four requirements may sound at first superficial, at the first superficial reading as easy of accomplishment, but if carefully studied, it will become apparent why the adept is the rare efflorescence of a generation of inquirers. So let us take up each of these four points. An adept is the rare efflorescence of a generation of inquirers. And so often in occultism, that which appears easy of attainment certainly is not, and is just veiling unsuspected depths. So inquire the way. Inquire the way. We are told by one of the masters. I so often wonder, as you know, that whether when he speaks of a master speaking, it isn't so often the master KH. He usually keeps the master involved anonymous when he speaks of something said by one of them. In the case of Master Serapis, he did give some very interesting definitions of time and space and the overcoming of time and space through the intuition. There he mentions the master. He has not mentioned, at least not as far as I can remember, the statements of Master KH, though no doubt since Master DK is a disciple of Master KH. No doubt, Master KH is responsible for a number of these statements which DK offers when he talks of a master speaking. He doesn't seem to offer from St. Paul, but there's a little bit, you know, about the kingdom of heaven suffereth violence and the violent take it by force. Yes, and a little bit from Master Moria, too, when speaking of that condition of irritation that we call imperil, and which becomes substantial and which precipitates itself on the walls of the nerves within. I guess there is quite an exchange between the masters, and they have a certain knowledge of what each other may be saying, especially the strongest and most powerful statements. You know, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? Enunciated by the Master Jesus on the cross, and DK explains that as the overcoming of illusion, of the great synthetic illusion, and realizing the realization by the Master Jesus, or the initiate Jesus at that time, that he is God. Yes, I think certain of the masters are quoted. I'm trying to think if there is a quote from a third ray adept. Well, it's not coming to my mind at the moment anyway. But Jesus, Paul, Serapis, Kutumi, I don't doubt at all that he's in there, because he's the one closest to Master DK, and Master Moria, I think various, all of them have been somehow quoted to a greater or lesser degree. Okay, so here we have Inquire the Way. We are told by one of the masters that a whole generation of inquirers may only produce one adept. That's not going to be enough when we realize how many fifth degree initiates will be needed in the relatively short term, but it does signal to us something of the difficulty of the process. We have to have that sense of proportion based on humility when we think of the demands of the requirements presented to us. Sometimes we really underestimate their difficulty. We are told by one of the masters that a whole generation of inquirers may produce only one adept. That's, you know, billions. Well, let's say there are millions of inquirers. There are billions of human beings. But of the many who thirst after illumination and ascension and life in the higher worlds, identified with the higher aspect of themselves, well, I suppose there are millions with aspiration burning at a certain level of intensity, but a generation, does he mean like 25 years or so, producing just one? Well, we begin to realize perhaps what it means to be an adept. Why should this be so? For two reasons. One, first, and the second. Okay, so firstly, first, the true inquirer is one who avails himself of the wisdom of his generation, who is the best product of his own period, and yet who remains unsatisfied with the inner longing for wisdom unappeased. That is a definition of the true inquirer. Very intelligent, very capable with regard to all that his generation may offer of knowledge and even of wisdom, but he's not satisfied. This divine discontent is burning in the hearts and mind of all those who will succeed in becoming adepts. To him, there appears to be something of more importance than knowledge, and something of greater moment than the accumulated experience of his own period and time, which, of course, you know, must be very limited. Some people I know are very intelligent, but they are captured by the idea that modern man is at the forefront of what man can know, and discount the thought that in previous times and among adepts and initiates and priests and those of the inner temple, that even more was known. They discount that entirely. Whatever man can know, he certainly knows now, and no knowledge has been lost. Well, I think that's a great mistake. But anyway, there appears to be something of more importance than knowledge, and something of greater moment than the accumulated experience of his own period and time. You know, his spirit within knows that omniscience will be his, and is discontent forever until omnipotence, omniscience, and omnipresence has been achieved. The spirit knows these things, and he is connecting with his spirit. He recognizes a further step on and seeks to take it in order to gain something to add to the quota already gained by his compeers. I really feel that Master DK is talking very much about himself. In Esoteric Psychology 1, he talks about the second-ray type, and he says that the second-ray type is ever unsatisfied with even his highest attainments. You know, I just have to, where is that? I will go there because it is an important quotation, and, you know, I wish this would hold. I'm probably doing something wrong, you know. But if we go to Psych 1, around page 203, I don't know, somewhere in there. I hit it this time. Okay, the student on this ray is ever unsatisfied with his highest attainments. No matter how great his knowledge, his mind is still fixed on the unknown, the beyond, and on the heights as yet unscaled. I find that to be such a definitive quotation about the inner longing of the second ray type, especially if on the knowledge aspect of the second ray. So I'm going to just put this in here, and this is EP1203. To him, there appears to be something of more moment, etc. He recognizes a step further on and seeks to take it in order to gain something to add to the quotas already gained by his compeers. He's really involved in the process, what I call monadic retraction, or emanative retraction. Nothing satisfies him until he finds the way. Let's call this, well, I know what's going to happen if I don't get myself another blue bracket. So I'll be pasting something that is irrelevant. So nothing satisfies him until he finds a way. And what is that way? Way of high revolution, leading even beyond the planet, beyond the cosmic physical plane, beyond our solar system. Okay. And nothing appeases the desire at the center of his being. Notice where that desire is coming from, and notice that desire is not to be discounted as a factor in the life of the advanced type. The planetary logos, the solar logos, and beyond, they have their desires too. So we're just talking about low desire for phenomenal occurrences and phenomenal acquisitions which cannot really be held. Those are the things that the Buddha says we have to dispense with. So nothing satisfies him until he finds the way, and nothing appeases the desire at the center of his being except that which is found in the house of his father. Well, you know, even then, there'll be more yearning for something still higher, but this is the yearning for Shambhala. He is what he is because he has tried all lesser ways and found them wanting, and has submitted to many guides only to find them blind leaders of the blind. These guides have all had their, what can I call it, Bucyric tendencies. You know, Bucyrus was found in the labor of Gemini, and he was the false teacher. At least he was a teacher who limited the possible attainment of his students by binding them too closely to him and to his thought and to his words and what he thought to be real. Bucyrus did not encourage the inner capacity of his students, but made repetitive mental slaves of them. And finally, you know, there was a overthrow. Hercules rebelled and bound Bucyrus to his own altar. Anyway, you know the story, and in the labors of Hercules, you can find the story. The Tibetan actually has written in the old commentary style, the story of the first seven labors, so Gemini is included. The early labors being more elaborate than we might otherwise expect, and when he stopped writing and others took over, naturally the labors could not be so elaborate, and much probably was left out that would have been patent to the Tibetans' understanding. In any case, he cannot follow others, really. He has to learn to follow his own inner, or in this case, inward wisdom, which of course he possesses. Nothing is left to him but to become his own guide and to find his own way home alone. So, you know, maybe inquiring the way is a bit of a lonely path. I remember I had a little bit of this maybe once in my life, because I had written a book on the rays and, you know, utilized much of what DK had said and thought of quite a bit based upon that. Thought of that myself. But then when I got into the infinitization book, it's like I put everything away. And I used a few points of contact. I had a tiny little book called, there was a translation of the Viveka Kudamani, the crest jewel of discrimination. It wasn't even the translation that the Tibetan recommended. I think he recommended a Chatterjee translation, I didn't realize that, and I didn't have it. So I just dealt with this little, very little book translation, and I used that as an occasional reference, but I felt that I had to find within my own understanding, and of course I've not yet found it, but within my own understanding, a way to present certain ideas. And now here it is, more than 20 years later, and I'm finding that I didn't go deep enough, and I'm going to be again relying upon my own wisdom, if I can access it, my own intuition. Of course, none of this really belongs to the individual, and that which is intuitive is like the golden hind on the hillside near the temple. You may capture the hind, but when you turn around, there it's going to be. The deer, the golden deer, will still be on the hillside. It doesn't really belong to anybody. So I think I have a little experience with this, and there is a question of self-trust. You have to give yourself permission to think through things on your own without holding the hand of the guide too tightly. So he has to find his own way home. In the loneliness, which is the lot of every true disciple, are born that self-knowledge and self-reliance which will fit him in his turn, to be a master. We really do have to develop this self-reliance, and we don't just mean this in a personal sense. Maybe some work on developing personal self-reliance will help us develop the self-reliance of one who identifies as a soul or a triad or even a monad eventually. But it doesn't stop at the personality, surely. And our next objective is to develop the self-reliance of the experienced soul that has been through many incarnations and can begin to learn to trust itself. It has seen and it has harvested the wisdom from experience. The loneliness is not due to any separative spirit, but to the conditions of the way itself. Well, we oftentimes talk of the path, but once the sixth initiation begins, we talk of the way. But maybe DK is speaking more generically here, and the way means the path. Aspirants must carefully bear this distinction in mind. It's not the loneliness of separativeness. It's the loneliness which the path forces upon every individual who would learn to access his own wisdom. What is the old saying, that knowledge dwells in the mind of those attentive to the thoughts of others? The wisdom dwells, I think it's in the heart of those attentive to their own thoughts. So this question of self-trust and making the leap into accessing the higher aspects of one's energy system, it's a bit of a perilous process and a little shaky, and we don't know when something good is coming of it at first, but we have to, without declaring the absolute truth of what we find within ourselves at first, we still have to risk it and not hold the hand of the superior guide too tightly, otherwise we'll never develop our own expression of the divine will. So inquire the way. That's the first thing about it. And let's see what he says here. the true inquirer. Okay. But he's, you know, let's just call it dissatisfaction of the spirit as the prompt to inquiry within oneself. Or maybe I should put it this way, oneself, the higher self, you know. Now, what else about an inquirer? Secondly, the true inquirer is one whose courage is of that rare kind which enables its possessor to stand upright and to sound his own clear note in the very midst of the turmoil of the world. There are all kinds of forces that want to knock you off your center, and that, because who are you, you know, they want to invalidate you in preference to those who have the reputation of certain knowledge, those who have established themselves as authorities. They want to take away your authority in favor of the authority of someone upon whom you simply should be relying, you know, so they think. But when you have the courage to stand up, it's pretty rare, he says, and to sound your own note clearly in the midst of all kinds of confusion and all kinds of dissuasion, all kinds of discounting and ridicule and all the rest, then you're on your way. He is the one who has the eye trained to see beyond the fogs and miasmas of the earth. You know, it sounds very much like the world of glamour on the astral plane, to that center of peace, Shambhala, which presides over all the earth's happenings and has that trained inner ear, that trained attentive ear, which, having caught a whisper of the voice of the silence, which is, from one perspective, the voice of the soul, is kept tuned to that high vibration and is thus deaf to all the lesser alluring voices that want to lead him back into the dense physical nature of the planetary logos. This again brings loneliness and produces that aloofness which all less evolved souls feel when in the presence of those who are forging ahead. It's not a separative aloofness. It's the aloofness, what can I call it? The aloofness of right attentiveness to the higher voice. One is always listening for what may be spoken on the higher and inner planes, or what may descend in symbolic form, and which then has to be deciphered. So what do we have here? See beyond, hear beyond, basically, is what this is all about. See beyond and hear beyond the immediate. And the immediate is lesser than what lies beyond. So, you know, you might, these people, they have to receive the best from their surroundings, but they have not to be bewildered the way so many people with a modern mind are bewildered about what is reality. They have to be attuned beyond the level of confusion or possible acquisition in the immediate surroundings. You take what is useful, but you see beyond and you hear beyond. A paradoxical situation is brought about from the fact that the disciple is told to inquire the way, and yet there is none to tell him. Well, what would you say? None other than the true self, which he is. Those who know the way may not speak, knowing that the path is constructed by the aspirant as the spinner spins its web out of the center of his own being. So we make our own connections through maybe light threads to the higher worlds, at least energy currents that allow a transmission from higher vibration to lower. Thus, only those souls flower forth into adepts in any specific generation who have, quote, trodden the winepress of the wrath of God alone. You know, in the old days, you stepped on the grapes and the juice was produced. You didn't rely. Well, and here you're not relying upon someone else to make your wine. You are doing it yourself. And in the process, there are many harrowing experiences to face the wrath of God. So we're talking about the flowering forth of the adept as a rare efflorescence, a rare flower of a generation of inquirers. Or who, in other words, those souls who have worked out their karma alone and have intelligently taken up the task of treading the path. Let's just say each individual is unique in expression and identical in essence. So we share something, we share identicality, and yet there is this aloneness experienced in our unique circumstances, and that unique part of the will of God, which it is our duty to bring into expression, maybe before successfully returning to the identicality. Okay, inquire the way. Well, as you can see, just a few paragraphs there, but how very important that we learn to rely upon ourselves. There is a divine discontent found within one and all, and it is produced by the spirit. The spirit, when immersed in matter, is ever discontent, especially once it has carried forward its manifestational responsibility. Then the spirit wants to return to the full expression of its own power, and maybe in the lower worlds of limitation, to return to full power, even within those lower worlds, or at least a much greater power than it achieved when first immersed. I call that sometimes prakritic immersion of the spirit. That's what happens in emanation. Prakriti is matter, you know, and the life, the being, the consciousness is immersed in ever more constricted circumstances because of the thickness of matter with which it must contend, the slower vibrations. How many times have we been through this? Well, you just cannot give it a definite number, because there'll always be a higher number and a higher number. So you can say in a way, cyclically forever. Cyclically forever. Now we go to the next injunction, or maybe we should call it a charge, you know, after passing through an initiation ceremony, there's going to be a charging up of the newly made initiate, and these energy is thrown into him via this charge. Let's see how big this is. 36. Okay. So, obey the inner impulses of the soul. Seems very straightforward, doesn't it? I mean, we're told to do this all the time, but when it actually comes, inward impulses. See, I did it again. I said inner, and for years I've been saying inner, so now I have to correct that. Inward impulses of the soul, but maybe really practically there's not, you know, so much difference. Well, do the teachers of the race instruct the budding initiate to practice discrimination and train him in the arduous task of distinguishing between. So, you know, on the fourth sublevel of the mental plane comes this factor of discrimination, and it's sort of the antechamber to entering the higher three subplanes of the soul, when real effective discrimination is established, then that entry into the realm of the soul, the transition area between, let's say, the dense physical body of the planetary logos and his cosmic etheric body. Like I say, you know, the higher three subplanes of the mental plane are in a way transitional. They are etheric from a certain point of view, and yet transitional into the cosmic ethers, where we can truly begin to live within a principled, cosmically principled area of the planetary logos and also of the solar logos. So distinguish between instinct and intuition. See, one has the full knowledge of why something is as it is, and the other may guide intelligently but unconsciously. Higher and lower mind, desire and spiritual impulse, and I suppose the spiritual impulse has more to do with aspiration, selfish aspiration, and divine incentive. One can aspire for better circumstances for the personality, but divine incentive has to do with the urge towards service and acquisition of higher potentialities and liberation, ultimately, the better to serve, and E, the urge emanating from the lunar lords and the unfoldment of the solar lord. Unfortunately, you know, we here on our Earth, we have this disintegrating body we call the moon, and it's part of the, was part of the third chain in the Earth scheme, and it met maybe an untimely end, or maybe it was indeed timely given the mistakes that were being made even by the planetary logos in relation to this moon chain. So we need a very sharp, discriminative mind. We need to see personality will be motivated largely by instinct, higher, lower mind, desire, selfish aspiration, and lunar urges. And that part of us which is the detached, ultimately detached soul and incarnation, the consciousness within the personality, will be motivated eventually by the intuition, and before that by the higher mind. And there will be a spiritual impulse which will elevate the quality of desire into aspiration and a yearning for the higher states. And there will be a reception of the higher levels of spirituality and even of divinity, which is higher still. And they will provide an incentive for the individual to reach in his desire body towards these sources, and not for the things of the phenomenal world against which the Buddha warns us. And we will have as well the unfoldment of the soul of the Lord to which the soul in incarnation attends. Less and less we as the observer within the personality, let's say, less and less we attend to the promptings of the personality, less and less, and more to the still small voice, to the cyclic radiation of the soul, which earlier in this book it tells us are our higher impulses. More and more we attend to those kinds of things, even in the midst of chaos, of fatigue, of apparent emotional upset, of mental confusion. All that can exist, but somehow our attentiveness is tracking the real source, which in this case is the soul, and still higher sources remain for us to come into rapport with, or with which to come into rapport. It's a subtle process, really, as we go through many, many difficulties, but always with the star, you know, the lodestar, the attractive star, the star of the monad, withdrawing an aspect of itself from immersion in matter. And we accordingly rise through higher and more intense, or higher and higher points of tension, reclaiming that which we lost upon our descent. But we never really lose it, but in terms of our immediate consciousness, it seems to be lost and is remote, but we realize it's always been a part of us. And as we ascend emanatively, or reascend, well, we've descended, so I guess we will ascend. We discover the vastness. Increasingly, we discover the vastness of our true spiritual and then divine nature. Requires patience, but, you know, I always ask myself, how many times have we been through this? And the answer is always more times than you can name specifically, no matter how great your number might be. So discrimination, this is the word here. And why is it important? Because there are many impulses. But do we know which are the inward impulses of the soul? Do we know? Or do we fail to separate this from that? And are we confused about which are the impulses of the soul? and which are simply the promptings of our lunar lords of the personal nature. It is no easy or flattering task. You know, in the beginning, people want to flatter themselves. They are spiritual aspirants, and they're cut above everybody else, and they have achieved what others have not achieved until they really, really look, and they have the privilege of seeing the residue which has to be uplifted and sublimated, burned away, thrown away, transformed, transmuted. You can't carry around the residue in an untransformed state. You just can't do that. It will hold you down. So it's no easy or flattering task to find oneself out and to discover that perhaps even the service which we have rendered and are longing to study and work has been basically selfish in origin and resting on a desire for liberation or a distaste for the humdrum duties of every day. Well, maybe we've discovered a little bit of that within ourselves. I think I have. And it's not flattering, and you really begin to question yourself. Why am I doing this? You know, what is my true motive? When the people came into his group, you know, he said, look, first thing you have to realize is that what has brought you into this group is not a burning desire to serve humanity, but basically the desire for spiritual attainment, spiritual ambition, you know, liberation, relief. So you have to begin with a hard look at the unpleasant truths, which are nonetheless truths. They have to be seen. He who seeks to obey the impulses of the soul has to cultivate an accuracy of summation and a truthfulness with himself, which is rare indeed these days. Well, we have many students, but how truthful are they with themselves? And do we have enough discernment to answer that question about truthfulness with ourselves? Let him say to himself, I must to my own self be true. It's a kind of a quotation from Hamlet by Shakespeare. Maybe it's even older than that, but Polonius gives some advice to his son Laertes, who is going to leave the castle and go off to study, I guess. And it shall follow as the night the day, thou canst not be false to any other man. Well, maybe, you know, different signs of the zodiac teach us to be true to our own self, and maybe somehow Leo teaches the most. Let him say to himself, I must to my own self be true, and in the private moments of his life and in the secrecy of his own meditation, let him not gloss over one fault, nor excuse himself along a single line. Well, DK is pretty demanding here, isn't he? Let him learn to diagnose his own words, deeds, and motives, and to call all things by their true names. It's very exacting, isn't it, then, to obey the inward impulses of the soul. Very exacting, and who is going to hold you to this standard of truth? I mean, the master is not going to materialize and say, no, you're not being truthful. You yourself, as an illuminating soul, have to see whether you're being truthful. And I'm sure there's many a hard moment, unflattering moment, when you see yourself as you are, and you understand your motives as they are, which are perhaps rarely as high as you think they are. Only thus will he train himself in spiritual discrimination and learn to recognize truth in all things. Only thus will the reality be arrived at and the true self be known. Well, DK, you know, is said to be a very truthful individual, and I've said before, I think Blavatsky was speaking about her time in Tibet, and DK was one of her instructors, still a young man, and something to this effect was said, that I know a youth so pure that no lie would ever escape his lips. And this would be a Master DK. He wasn't yet a master. I guess he was an arhat at that time. Excuse me. And in 1875 became a master. Interestingly, the same year, these are related, that the founding of the Theosophical Society took place. So, truth in all things, if you are to obey the inner impulses, the inward impulses of the soul. It's really the use of the fifth ray, cultivating an accuracy of summation, and, you know, willing to see the unpleasant aspects within oneself. I suppose Pluto is involved here as well, because it does tend to unearth that which is hidden, and to bring it up before the eye of the observer, and then you just have to admit it. You know, sometimes your computer gets invaded by all kinds of promptings, but I've learned that don't try to do something else while you're trying to do this, or you'll pay the price. Okay. So, obey the inward impulses of the soul, and you have to discriminate what they really are, and you have to be very truthful as you purify yourself, so you can obey these inward impulses. Sometimes what is very pleasant, you know, you think, well, if it's spiritual, it's got to be pleasant. I have to be enjoying it, but sometimes the most dire type of requirements are offered in the line of true spirituality, and not that which is pleasant at all. And we have to learn to achieve certain eliminations which we didn't even suspect. Maybe other people are pointing them out to us somehow, you know, and we maybe don't believe them. They tell us how we are, and we don't believe them, and then we have to see it ourselves. So there are things in the way still for all of us who are reading books like this, you know. There are things in the way all the way up, of course. Always there's an impediment to the next stage of achievement. So you don't let yourself off the hook. And, you know, you think about Leo there for a minute and the cave that Hercules encounters, where the lion races in the lower self, the personal nature, and Hercules says, okay, I'll take care of you now. But the lion runs out the back door, or the back entrance, and then maybe runs in again, and it's very elusive. Process. The lion of pride, the lion of lower personality is elusive until Hercules takes the step and says, look, I won't let you escape. I will now block the escape route. And then he can chase the lion into the cave, and the confrontation takes place, and Hercules really sees himself as he is, and he kills that lion and becomes the victor over his lower self. There are different ways to kill a lion. Hercules kills a lot of things with his club, but the unicorn blinds the lion with his weapon of revelation, you know, the horn of the unicorn, and maybe kills it too. Well, there's a lot of things that we have to kill out. Just read Master Hilarion in his book, The Light of the Soul. Was that it? Light on the Path? Maybe that's it. And it just starts off, kill this, kill out that, kill this, kill that. You know, he's a first-ray monad, and he has us deal with a lot of eliminations, but he balances them by, let's say, kill out ambition, but work as one who is ambitious. You know, he always finds the harvest of some quality in that which you have killed. So I guess one of the things that comes to us as we're treading the path is just how difficult it is really to tread the path. This is beyond the estimation of the aspirant who, you know, cannot foresee how thorny is the path of occultism. But we all learn in time, and what we are unwilling to do at the beginning, we are willing to do later, because we've seen the necessity for it. Now, here's another one. Well, you know, pay no attention to worldly wisdom, basically, he's saying. That must be tough, because everybody's saying, well, you look at, you're not listening to the best and the smartest among us here. You're not taking advantage of what everybody knows and somehow should follow. But you get rid of that particular should, because you know that it may pay off in terms of the world, but it's not going to pay off in terms of your spiritual approach. Pay no consideration to the prudential. You know, you have to be prudent, right? Prudent means wise, really. Prudential considerations of worldly science and sagacity and, well, worldly knowledge, we might say, and sagacity, the wisdom, the apparent wisdom of the world. If the aspirant has need to cultivate a capacity to walk alone, that's the first one. If he has to develop the ability to be truthful in all things, otherwise you can't achieve this obedience to the soul and import the qualities of the soul and identify as a soul. So he's summarizing here. He has likewise the need to cultivate courage. So he's going to look at this from the point of view of courage, where you stand up and you sound your own note, despite the fact that worldly wisdom, knowledge, sagacity may go against what you say. When Einstein was discovering the theories of relativity, you know, special and general, the German scientists thought it was absolute nonsense. And then, you know, in their sort of fifth-ray concrete way, they could not follow him because he really accessed the intuition and had a tremendous abstract mind. But he had to offer his truth as he understood it, despite the withering criticism which was directed towards him. It will be needful for him to run counter consistently to the world's opinion and to the very best expression of that opinion, and this with frequency. Well, I suppose DK is speaking as one who knows, has been through it, especially since his work lies in the realm, it seems, of knowledge and wisdom, you know, a very brilliant mind, very learned individual. But you have to sort of stand up. And sometimes, Giordano Bruno tried to stand up, and he had great conceptions of what the universe might be, and even was kind of intuiting the idea of the speed of light, that what one was observing of the heavens was not really as it is right now, but you're observing many times simultaneously. This star, the light from this star occurred at that time, the light from another star at another time. It's not how things are right now. It's a composite. Well, he had a very expansive point of view. He tried to offer the cosmic perspective in the midst of the Counter-Reformation, or when the Counter-Reformation was beginning, and the guardians of the scripture were very frightened at the Reformation, which was taking place in Germany and in Europe, Northern Europe. So they were unusually harsh with him. Plus, he had a keen wit and a bit of sarcasm, and he had criticized them a little too pointedly, I guess. But in any case, courage to offer the way you see things. And they may be very, very different. I realized, you know, in choosing the path of occultism, when you talk to those people who are nourished on the best that science can offer at this time and think no further, it's a tough sell. Occultism is a tough sell. And the worldview of the conventionally knowledgeable and wise just cannot yet embrace it. Maybe step by step, as the etheric body is discovered and as its functions are revealed, maybe some encompassing of the occult presentation will occur. And there are some scientists, of course, who are making the bridge, but not the majority. So it will be needful for him to run counter consistently to the world's opinion and to the very best expression of that opinion, and this with frequency. He has to learn to do the right thing as he sees and knows it, irrespective of the opinion of the Earth's greatest and most quoted. And some of these greatest and most quoted may be even those who broke ground earlier and ran against what was the prevailing wisdom. We're assuming that quantum theory has some merit, and it's certainly widely accepted among many now, but Einstein rejected it. And God does not play dice with the world, something like that. The consideration of what chance was. Anyway, some of these quantum theorists had to run counter to Einstein as the great authority. So, you know, his ideas, Einstein's ideas, had settled into the public mind as sacrosanct as the truth. And yet there was more to be discovered. So I don't know enough about it, but looking at it from the fifth-ray perspective, Einstein had his theory of relativity, and Niels Bohr had the quantum theory, and they were both colleagues in a way, and or contemporaries. What was the interaction? So he must depend upon himself and upon the conclusions he himself has come to in his moments of spiritual communion and illumination. It is here that so many aspirants fail. Okay, well, better better to be warned, right? They do not do the very best they know. They fail to act in detail as their inner voice tells them. They leave undone certain things which they are prompted to do in their moments of meditation, and fail to speak the word which their spiritual mentor, the self, urges them to speak. Well, we have to test ourselves against what the Tibetan just said. It is here that so many aspirants fail. And it is in the aggregate of these unaccomplished details that the big failures are seen. It's not that you fail once, it's just over time we continue to make the same mistakes. And we demonstrate the same type of spiritual cowardice. It is in the aggregate of these unaccomplished details that the big failures are seen. There are no trifles in the life of the disciple, and an unspoken word or unfulfilled action may prove the factor which is holding a man from initiation. So, practical advice, but very earnest somehow, and not leaving the opportunity for evasion. You know, evasion is a subtle factor. I'm sure we've all experienced it, and how do we escape from the implications or the demands of the still small voice? Maybe we've covered it over so thoroughly that in certain areas of our inner discourse, the voice isn't even coming through anymore. And, you know, the solving of that problem or the carrying out of that behest will have to be accomplished at another time. Maybe one shouldn't ask to have all of one's karma precipitated immediately. You know the story of what happened to the colleague of Blavatsky, T. Suba Ro, apparently her spiritual equal, but he really, through an act of courage, maybe courage, he importuned his teacher to release the full weight of his karma. And, well, I'm sure the results were liberating, but they were horrible at the same time in terms of disease. So courage, right? Courage. He has to likewise cultivate courage, and I'm going to make that a very big word. Likewise develop courage and speak his own revelation. You know, there's this factor of inauthenticity when you're speaking from the study of another person whom maybe you don't even fully understand. Somehow you're evading your own inner truth. Maybe they are quite close, but you have to find your own inner truth, because as an emanation, you are unique in your responsibility. There is a type of carrying forward of the will, of the purpose, of the plan, which is yours and yours alone. And if your voice is missing from the general presentation of these factors, aspects of the divine will, then something is missing in the carrying forward of the divine will. So, in these discussions, you will sometimes see that I kind of take a little path and offer a type of commentary which might not be found in DK, because it is the product of my own thought, and I have to kind of present it in the context where I think it does belong. Now, it may be correct or incorrect, or correct in part and incorrect in part, but you'll never know if you don't present it and it doesn't, if it fails to meet the test of confrontation with other ideas or formulations which may prove it to be correct or incorrect. So even the little things count, and as Master Moria tells us, even the smallest grain of sand can stop the largest wheel. So there are no little things, and as Moria says again, so often his life was saved. He said he was very rarely assassinated or anything like that, even though he occupied positions of power. He was very rarely assassinated because he observed the little things, which revealed to him much bigger things. So be aware of what apparently are the trifles, and also realize that these trifles, these tiny little things, can be much more important than we imagine, and actually, because we don't have the courage to perform them or to take care of them, we may be holding ourselves back from the next possible step. I mean, this is certainly one of the most practical areas in the Tibetan's presentation here in the White Magical Book. So this is this one here, you know, let's just say truthfulness is so important. And in the next one, having the courage to pay attention to your own wisdom and not what is suggested to you to be a better and higher wisdom than your own, and asks you to forego or to stop paying attention to your own wisdom. That would be a big mistake, you know, and this kind of decision to go with one's own inward wisdom relates to the idea that better one's own karma or dharma than the dharma of another. You may be able to perform very well the dharma of another, but it's not your dharma. And by not performing your own, you leave an aspect of the will of God unaccounted for, and the divine plan cannot fully manifest if you don't do your particular task. All right, and then the final one, live a life which is an example to others. Well, is it necessary, he says, for me to enlarge upon this? It seems as if it should not be, and yet here again is where men fail. It's possible to know a lot and do little, to sense the whole and yet remain apart. It's a second-rate failing. It's possible to be a know-it-all, but not a do-it-all. So somehow, you know, in the 12-step programs, it tells us we have to walk our talk. It's so essentialized in the way that has been presented. Men fail here. What, after all, is group service? Simply the life of example. I guess, you know, it's not so much what we say. That has an effect, of course, and can inspire. But we're all watching each other, you know. We're all observing our behavior. We see. Each sees and knows the villainy of each, and yet there is, with this great revelation, no shakiness upon the road. What is it? No turning back. No spurning of each other, no shakiness upon the road. We see. Everyone sees. And at a certain stage in development, it's quite impossible to hide what one is. So what, after all, is group service? Simply the life of example. He is the best exponent of the ageless wisdom who lives every day in the place where is the life of the disciple. He does not live it in the place where he thinks he should be. So often that's just a question of spiritual ambition. I mean, what I am, what you are, has brought me, has brought you to the place where we are. And we might prefer to be elsewhere. It might be much more interesting, you know, let's just say, but according to what we have been and what we are, here we are. So if we're forever longing, you know, oh, you know, if only I was out of the house, not taking care of the kids, then I could really be a disciple, you know. And then you leave behind, unaccomplished, a certain developmental stage, which has to be completed. Otherwise, you really can't go on. And the people, let's say, you know, who on the way to Calvary, let's say, they ignore Bethlehem and they try to step out in the world and be somebody, they're forced back and back into Bethlehem, you know, into the original stage where you have to pay your duties, maybe to the lunar lords and to the manifested beings on very humble levels. If that's not fulfilled, you know, if that bit of merit is not accumulated, then you're not really free to go forward, no matter how you may force yourself to go forward, and you suffer in the new place as you realize that the old requirement is not fulfilled, and you're thrown back into it. What's the old saying that the mills of the gods grind slow, but exceeding fine. Every little fault and non-observance, every little error, you know, these things are detected and they have to be handled. Perhaps, after all, the quality which produces the greatest number of failures among aspirants to adeptship, I guess that's all of us who are treading the path of probationary initiation or initiation, is cowardice. Ooh. All right, that's a tough one. Perhaps, after all, the quality which produces the greatest number of failures among aspirants to adeptship is cowardice. Well, there's something to think about. And, you know, I guess if we weren't cowardly, cowed, hiding, you know, in some level of our nature, we would have made much more rapid progress than at present. Men fail to make good where they are because they find some reason which makes them think they should be elsewhere. Men run away almost unrealizing it from difficulty, from inharmonious conditions, from places which involve problems, and from circumstances which call for action of a high sort and which are staged. Great stage director, the soul, you know, to draw out the best that is in a man, provided he stays in them. They flee from themselves and from other people instead of simply living the life. Whoa, this is such sound advice for so many. See, immediately I can think of many people to whom I would recommend this, which must certainly mean that I have to recommend it to myself. But it is a very somehow recommendable passage because, you know, we all suffer from a type of divine discontent, whether we realize what it is or not. And that divine discontent can drive us towards premature exit from the place and circumstances in which we could fulfill our spiritual duty and acquire new capacities and fulfill certain karmas of the past. So it's so practical. And you know, if I on some gloomy day when it's don't see the sun for days, you know, and you can ask, well, you know, what am I doing here? What am I doing? You know, why am I here? I would rather be, I, the little self, would rather be, and then I forget that these circumstances have been staged by the soul so often and are the place where I, where you have to make good. We have to make good where we are. It's true we might have been somewhere else had our decisions been otherwise, but we made those decisions on the basis, again, of who we are. What is our energy configuration of the moment? So if we want to have a new pattern, we have to fulfill and get the best out of the pattern in which we find ourselves. Live a life which is an example to others. So inquire the way, obey the inward impulses of the soul, pay no attention to strictly worldly, strictly worldly wisdom or sagacity, and live a life which is an example to others. So simple, these four recommendations, and we could test ourselves every day. The more I think about it, the more I realize that this book could be read with such profit by so many. You know, it's nice to race off and get into cosmic fire and the rays and the initiations and so forth. But then again, how is the foundation built except by fulfilling the abundant requirements that we find here? The adept speaks no word that can hurt, harm, or wound. Of course, people do, you know, they are wounded sometimes by the words of truth coming from the adept in DK's group. People, well, he said the truth in as skillful and kind and helpful a way as he could, and then they just quit, you know. Because their what sensitive astral body was hurt. But this is certainly a purposeful approach of no word that can hurt, harm, or wound. I'm sure we could go back, you know, just ask yourself, when have I hurt, harmed, or wounded someone through my words? And immediately, bang, 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 these things are going to come to us, and you can live with a chagrin, you know, stopped in your tracks by the shame of the past. Therefore, he has to learn the meaning of speech in the midst of turmoil. He wastes no time in self-pity or self-justification, for he knows the law has placed him where he is and where he can best serve. And has learnt that difficulties are ever of a man's own making and the result of his own mental attitudes. If the incentive to justify himself occurs, he recognizes it as a temptation to be avoided. You know, that finger of enticement that we talked about, how we have to avoid temptation. He realizes that each word spoken, each deed undertaken, and every look and thought has its effect for good or for evil upon the group. So such attentiveness to one's own expression in thought, word, and deed. You know, self, we need self observation. Without self preoccupation. And you know, if we look on at our lower self long enough, can we stay away from identifying with that self or as that self? Is it not apparent, therefore, why so few achieve and so many fail? Well, word to the wise, you know. We have been warned, we have been advised, and we've been given four great injunctions here concerning the fulfillment of that which will one day make of a man an adept. Well, I don't have any idea really where I am in terms of time, but what I'm going to do before starting this new section, which will be number 10, is we start out at 581 and we have made it a little bit of the way through, not very much. To whatever page, 587, 581 to 587. So here is 581 to 587. And it's rule 14 and 14.3. I don't know in how many parts, maybe 2.5 parts. So this is the end of number 9, and we're going to be, if I'm doing this properly, we're going to begin doing number 10, and it's going to be 14.4. It's going to be the fourth. Yeah, it's going to be the fourth program on rules for the physical plane. Etheric physical plane, really. And maybe, although the hour is late, I'll be able to start and go forward with this awakening of the centers. We are still about 53 book pages away from the end of the book. I have this slight anxiety about finishing it before I have to go to the United States, but let's just see. You can never tell how fast you'll go, you know, what you'll meet, how you have to try to explain what may occur to you of a useful or maybe sometimes not a useful nature. But this seems a very big section here, the awakening of the centers, and I think then it can be time for us now to stop this particular program. So thank you, everybody, for your studies. Study very hard. Incorporate these matters deeply into yourself. And for all of us, you know, the advice to be able to walk our talk, to be able to express in action that which we think, especially that which we think of a high nature, and then we can become true examples of the soul and be on our way to becoming one day a rare efflorescence of a generation of inquirers, and hopefully then it won't just be one per generation, but because we begin to know what we're doing, there'll be a sufficient number per generation to make the stage of adeptship an accomplished fact. More masters will be needed. Group initiation will be taking place, a great period of radiation, or we might call it ingathering, is with us now. So the ranks of the ashrams have to be filled, and the different sub-ashrams have to be filled out. There's a increase in the numbers of those who have to achieve success. Okay, we'll talk to you soon, and thank you for, all I can say is like studying with me. Because as you can see, I'm studying as I go along, and maybe we're sharing this this joy of studying the Master's words and his thoughts. Then it just remains for us to apply them in the right way. See you soon.